Welcome to Two-Way Street. We're going to talk today to two authors whose works have been included in the 2016 list of 10 books that every Georgian should read. The list is compiled annually by the Georgia Center for the Book, which is an affiliate of the Library of Congress. One of those authors is former Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporter Jim Ockmoody. The other, Kevin Young, a poet who also teaches at Emory University. First, Jim Ockmoody. His book is The Class of 65, A Student, A Divided Town, and The Long Road to Forgiveness. It's the story of Greg Whitcamper, a young man who grew up at Koinonia, an interracial farming commune in Americus during some of the worst days of racial strife in the surrounding community. Ockmoody describes how Whitcamper was brutally bullied for his association with Koinonia. And along the way, we also learn the remarkable story of the commune's visionary founder, Clarence Jordan. We talked to Jim when his book was first published in the spring of 2015. Jim Ockmoody, welcome to Two-Way Street. What was Koinonia?
Koinonia was an experimental religious community, a Christian farming commune that was founded in 1942 in Sumter County, about 8 miles from where Jimmy Carter grew up in Plains. Koinonia was founded by Southern Baptist minister Clarence Jordan, uncle of Hamilton Jordan, a White House chief of staff under the Carter administration. He was a Southern Baptist minister who wasn't very typical of Southern Baptist ministers at that time. In the 30s and 40s, he believed in racial equality. He believed in pacifism, nonviolence, and he believed in communal living. And he wanted to establish a farm somewhere in the South where a band of believers could live like the early Christians, sharing their resources and in total brotherhood.
So Koinonia is founded, and they are a working farm. They, among other things, are they're egg producers.
Mm-hmm.
What was the picture on the carton of the eggs that Koinonia sold?
They developed a poultry business down there and sold eggs. And the carton of eggs was sure to raise a lot of eyebrows around there because it showed two hands clasping, one white and one black. But generally speaking, people left them alone. They were not considered a threat to the social order. They were just different.
Yeah.
What changed that was the Supreme Court decision about public schools, Brown versus Board of Education.
In 1954.
That actually, you know, as you well know, it inflamed racial attitudes in the South because it was the first serious threat to the way of life, to segregation, to Jim Crow. But even then, that didn't really get people riled up against Koinonia. What got them riled up was that in early 1956, almost 2 years after the Supreme Court decision, Clarence Jordan went to Atlanta to endorse a handful of black students who wanted to go to what is now Georgia State University.
Yeah, it was Georgia Business College, I think.
It was Georgia Business College then. And they wanted to enter that school. And, of course, the university system then was strictly segregated. And by the time he got driven back to Americus that day, it was on the front of the Americus Times Recorder newspaper that local minister wants to desegregate university systems.
Yes, and it came to the attention of the governor at the time, Marvin Griffin, correct?
Right.
Who was not pleased that there was this white man in Americus who was stirring up trouble by suggesting that black students be admitted to the George Business College. And what did Marvin Griffin do as a result of that knowledge?
Well, the first thing he did was he called the sheriff in Sumter County, Fred Chappell, and said, "Who is this Jordan fella?" And over the next couple of years, the state of Georgia launched an investigation against Koinonia based on the idea that they were communists. This was the height of the Cold War. The state did everything they could to be hostile to them. And the local government was extremely hostile. What happened was the day that Jordan got back from having endorsed these students, that very day, vandalism started against the farm. And this kind of thing hadn't happened before. They started having fruit trees cut down, sugar poured in gas tanks, and it escalated from there. People stopped doing business with them. They wouldn't sell them farm supplies. They wouldn't buy their eggs. The only place they could sell their eggs were a few black groceries down the road in Albany. Pretty much everything that they had based their business model on dried up. But even scarier than that, they started becoming victims of direct violence. They had a roadside stand out on U.S. 19 between just south of Americus. It was bombed twice, destroyed completely the second time. They were shot at. There were drive-by shootings. There was a sniper fire into the house where Clarence Jordan lived that was aimed at the window where he usually sat in an easy chair reading. So they didn't get him. He just happened not to be there that night. But it looked very much like an assassination. That period kind of came to an end in 57. There was a feed and seed store in downtown Americus called Birdsey's that was owned by a businessman in Macon. And he had read all about what Koinonia was going through, and he decided that, you know, well, I don't see any problem selling to these people, you know. That's just capitalism. I'll sell to them. Well, within a week of him having started selling stuff to them, it was bombed. Right there in the middle of Americus, right across from the old courthouse. Damaged the courthouse clock, the bombing. And it closed after that. And the powers that be in Americus sort of got together and got out the word to the vigilantes and the Klan and those types who were doing these things that, you know, we don't like them either, but don't be setting off bombs in the middle of Americus.
The question arose, obviously, repeatedly, why Clarence Jordan didn't just pack up and move Koinonia somewhere more hospitable. And you have a speech, an excerpt from a speech that he gave on that very subject.
You know, I heard this on a recording up at the University of Georgia at the Hargrett Library up there. And it was the last thing actually I did after I'd spent several days going through the Clarence Jordan papers at the University of Georgia. And when I was walking back out to my car, I had tears in my eyes.
Well, read it if you wouldn't mind.
This is Clarence Jordan speaking to a group where they had asked him why he just didn't leave. Clarence said, I want to tell you why we don't sell out and move away. 15 years ago, we went there and bought that old eroded piece of land. It was sick. There were gashes in it, and it was sore and bleeding. I don't know whether you've ever walked over a piece of ground that could cry out to you, heal me, heal me. I don't know whether you feel the closeness to the soil that I do. When you fill in those old gullies and terrace the fields, you begin to feel the springiness of the sod beneath your feet, and you see that old land come to life. When you walk through a little old pine forest that you set out as little seedlings and now see them reaching for the sky and hear the wind through them, when you walk a little further over a bit of ground where your child is buried, the Jordans had lost a newborn son in 1955, and you go over to a hill where your children and many visitors have held picnics, when you walk around the creek that you've bathed in during the heat of the summer, and men say to you, why don't you sell it? Move away? You might as well say, why don't you sell your mother?
With that in mind, I think it's a great time to introduce your main character, Greg Whitcamper. He grew up at Koinonia from the time he was a young boy.
Greg's family moved to Koinonia when he was about to start first grade in the summer of 1953.
His father was sort of an itinerant preacher who could never hold on to a job. He kept getting fired because he was outspoken in one way or another. Is that right?
Yeah, Will Whitcamper, his father, was a Disciples of Christ minister from Indiana, and he had gone all over the place to these different churches, and they would really like him because he was really good with music, and he was a really good old-time fundamentalist preacher, but then he would tell them that their sons and couldn't join the military. And, of course, this wasn't a very popular thing to be telling churchgoers in the 1940s during World War II and right after World War II. And so they would always ask him to leave. And so almost immediately from the time that they're there, they're starting to get harassed and persecuted and targeted with violence. And what happened was that after the powers that be in Americus kind of called off the dogs on the bombing and stuff like that, the conflict between Koinonia and the outside the surrounding community really moved into the schools.
And I want to get to that. But before we do, let's point out how Greg grew up. Because he was part of this community, he was taught that black people and white people ought to live together and get along. He was taught nonviolence. There was a wonderful episode you describe in the book where the families at Koinonia are terribly troubled about what to do about the fact that kids like Greg wanted to have toy guns to play with, right?
And they made them all bring, they had a big service where they brought in all their weapons of violence, even faux weapons of violence, and put them into fire barrels as like a ritual cleansing of all violent impulses in the community. The next step on this was that Koinonia actually had to go to federal court to get three of its teenage children admitted into America's high school.
Right.
They lived in the county. America's was the city school. County kids routinely went to the city school because it was considered the best school in the county. But the city board did not want to accept them because they thought there was going to be all sorts of harassment and violence directed at them, and they were right. And so in the fall of 1960, there were these three teenagers from Koinonia who got admitted by a federal court order in Macon, admitted into America's High School. One of them was Greg's older brother, Billy.
Mm-hmm.
Greg started high school the following fall, in the fall of 1961. The whole time Greg was in high school, from the fall of 1961 through to his senior year in the fall of 1964, it was a period when all of this stuff was coming home to Southwest Georgia, and protests were starting on the streets of Albany and then later the streets of Americus. So the feelings were really, really raw.
When Greg entered Americus High School, he was tormented because he was from Koinonia.
Yes, all of the Koinonia.
He was part of that oddball community that embraced interracial harmony.
And they didn't just embrace it. They actually were very supportive of it.
So long before the school was actually integrated, Greg was already ostracized, marginalized. No one wanted to talk to him. The portrait you paint of him is a kid who shows incredible courage to just go to school every day. But it's a very sad story about a young man who knows he'll never have a girlfriend because none of the white girls will ever have anything to do with him, really doesn't expect to have any friends at all. He kind of just soldiers through day to day.
He tries to talk as little as he can in class. He sort of stays in his own mental bubble. People spit on him. They urinated in his locker. They hit him with paper clips in the hall. They called him all sorts of names. On several occasions, he was actually physically assaulted. But he said the thing that was actually the most painful to him was just some of the girls that he knew better, who just totally ignored him. When he would come down the hall, they would turn on their heel and face the other way.
We should say Greg was a good-looking kid. He was big. He was handsome. He was incredibly strong because he worked on the farm every day. So in many ways, had circumstances been different, he probably would have been one of the most popular kids in school.
Oh, he could have been on the football team. He was really fast. He would have been a really good linebacker or probably running back. And, you know, at one point, one coach actually sort of raised the suggestion with him, why don't you come out for the team? And Greg was just like, well, that's the last thing in the world I want to do, because if I start getting out there at practice, I'm just giving them an excuse to knock my block off every day.
We're going to take a short break, but when we continue, we'll have more of my conversation with Atlanta author Jim Auchmuty. His book, The Class of 65, has just been named as one of the 10 books every Georgian should read by the Georgia Center for the Book. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. If you're just joining us, I'm talking to Jim Auchmuty. He's the author of The Class of 65, A Student, A Divided Town, and The Long Road to Forgiveness. It's the story of Greg Whitcamper, a young man who grew up on an interracial farming commune in Americus during some of the worst days of racial strife in the surrounding community. We talked with Jim when the book was first published in the spring of 2015.
In the fall of 1964, when Greg started his senior year at Americus, he had already been harassed and tormented all through his high school, but things got really bad during his senior year because that fall, the city school system admitted four black students on a token basis to try to head off what they knew was coming down the road. So it was a good stand on their part. It was something that a lot of school systems at that time weren't even doing. And they tried to sort of keep it hidden. They didn't make any public announcement about it. And so on the first day of classes, nothing much happened. But on the second day of classes, a lot happened. There was a mob out there at the beginning of the school day, and Greg did something that really sort of crystallized everything. He went to class on the second day of school riding in the black funeral home limousine that was taking three of the four black students to class. So there's a little rock scene out there. There's a bunch of people out there cursing, spitting, throwing rocks and bottles, and this funeral home limousine pulls up in front of the school, and instead of a black kid getting out, the first kid out of the limousine was this white kid. It was Greg Whitcamper, a kid from Koinonia, who was just trying to show his support for desegregation and for these students who he knew them all. They were actually his friends. The white students wouldn't be his friends. His friends were the black students on the other side of town. And so all of the feelings about Greg and being this miscreant from Koinonia became even more heightened that fall because he was the only child from Koinonia in the entire school. Everybody was really upset about desegregation. And there Greg is stepping out of the limousine. He was considered a traitor to his race.
There's an incident in the book that really kind of, for me, is the sort of the climactic episode in terms of students confronting him and his committing to nonviolence. There's actually a confrontation in which a student hits him.
Greg was sitting in the government class one day, and one of the football players, Thomas Jordan, came walking by him, and I don't know if he tripped over Greg's leg or whether he just feigned tripping, but he turned around and accused Greg of tripping him. And Greg said something like, "Oh, TJ, don't be a baby." And one of the other students said, "You know what he just called you, TJ? He called you a bastard." And over the next day and a half, this became, it spread all through school that Greg was going to meet Thomas Jordan after school for a fight. And Greg was leaving school on the second day of this. It took a while to build up. And was walking back along the old baseball grandstand. And as he was coming up on the grandstand, he could see Thomas and two or three other guys standing there waiting for him. As he got closer to the grandstand, a whole group, probably about 50 boys, came out and sort of surrounded him. And they weren't going to be happy unless he fought Thomas. Yeah. And Greg said, "Well, I'm not going to fight you." And one of the other kids came and knocked the books out of Greg's hand. And while he was trying to sort of gather up his stuff, Greg really had the feeling Thomas really didn't want to hit him. This was all about what was expected by the crowd. But Thomas hauled off and with the ball of his fist hit him in the cheek really hard. And Greg kind of staggered. He didn't fall, but he kind of staggered. And a lot of stuff was going through his head. Clarence Jordan had actually told him before that he knew everything that he was going through at school, and he wondered whether this nonviolence thing was really right for kids, that he knew Greg was strong, he could take care of himself. He had told him one time, if you ever feel like you want to fight back, I think the Bible would allow that. It would be okay. And Greg was just astounded because Clarence Jordan was this very prominent prophet of nonviolence, and he was basically giving him permission to whoop ass. And so all this was going through Greg's head after he got hit. But he went back on what the community believed in nonviolence, and right out of Jesus' teachings, he stuck his chin back to Thomas like he was waiting to get hit on the other cheek, and he said, "Thomas, I love you." And nobody knew what to say. Yeah. It just sort of disarmed the situation.
Yeah.
And that fall in particular, he was very mistreated.
His whole high school experience was filled with this sort of incident. And yet, your book is the story of redemption. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. What happened was it was always a minority of the students who were actually directly harassing and assaulting Greg. But the most of the students either stood on the periphery and laughed while these things were happening or kind of egged it on, or they didn't say anything when they knew better. And so Greg always had this impression that, you know, most of these kids just things are changing and they haven't caught up yet. And if I had been born in their houses instead of at Koinonia, I'd be just like them. So he never was that very judgmental about it. And what happened was that they were coming up on their 40th class reunion.
Yeah, Greg is living at this point in West Virginia?
he had gravitated. He had gone off to college with this incredible college experience with the Quakers, where he went around the world studying world religions. And it was just what his brain needed after all the stuff he'd gone through in America, as he went out and saw the world. And he ended up settling in West Virginia. And Greg had lived up there since the mid-70s. And one of the classmates who was planning the reunion was this guy, David Morgan, who's a banker in Perry, Georgia. And Greg had always thought that he was the one who was probably the most sympathetic to him in high school. And David and a couple of his other classmates, when they were planning this reunion, sort of said, well, you know, what about Greg?
Greg goes out to his mailbox to get his mail and finds an invitation to the reunion and a letter from David Morgan, correct?
He finds a letter from David Morgan on the first day, and it's just a beautiful letter.
Throughout the last 40-plus years, I have occasionally thought of you and those dark days that you endured at our hands. As I matured, I became more and more ashamed and wished that I had taken a different stand back then. I knew even then that it was all wrong, yet I did nothing to stop it, or even to discourage it. I secretly admired your ability to take such abuse without retaliating. All I can do now is say that I am sorry, acknowledge the good principles behind Koinonia's existence, and commend you for your courage. I hope that the hatred and hardship you endured at our hands has made you stronger and more resolute in your character and faith. You were right. I hope God has smiled on you for holding fast and suffering in His name. God bless you for your pacifist courage, and God forgive me for participating in your torment. David Morgan.
And the next day, he gets a whole, you know, another handful of letters from other classmates. What had happened was that David and one of his classmates, Deanie Dudley, and a couple of others had sort of orchestrated this letter-writing campaign, and they did it in a way that Greg would get all the letters within a few days of each other for maximum impact. And they were all basically asking for forgiveness and saying, would you please come back? It's time to reconcile. A great deal of this book really has to do with some of these classmates who had been raised in segregation and had been raised to think certain things about black people. And then when they get to be seniors in high school, everything is changing. And it's really about how do you get from being a person who believes that segregation is right and that this kid from Koinonia is an infidel, how do you get from that to being a person who writes this eloquent letter 40 years later saying, we were wrong, please forgive us? What I keep telling people is this isn't a book just about bad things that happened in the Deep South 50 years ago. It's really about how people's hearts can change and the promise of reconciliation. One of the other interesting guys is this fellow Joseph Logan, who I liked a lot. Mm-hmm. Joseph was a member of the—he was co-captain of the football team in their senior year and was probably of the people who later reached out to Greg was the one who was probably most dead set against him in high school. And he became a teacher. And he started teaching—he was teaching business at a community college in Enterprise, Alabama. Mm-hmm. And a lot of his students were black. And it totally changed him to be suddenly in charge of the education of young black people. How could you not see them as human beings then? And he would go home, and his stepfather, who was very old, you know, set in his ways and was pretty bigoted, he would always make a big deal about how many black kids are you teaching, except he wouldn't use that word. And Joseph started getting very irritated by it. And, you know, Joseph told me that he's you know, the most popular show in America then was All in the Family. He said he came to see his stepfather as Archie Bunker and me, God help it, as Meathead.
This story that you tell really is, as you've said, a story of the ability of people to change and grow and to redeem themselves. And the story of the South is, to some extent, that story too, isn't it?
Of course it is. I mean, anybody, we've just been through all this stuff with Selma and the 50th anniversary of that. And it's like Obama and any number of other people have said, if you can't if you look at the way things were in 1965 and look at the way things are now, yeah, there's a lot of stuff we still need to do. There's still a lot of progress and a lot of hearts that still need to be changed. I think what's changed is much more significant than what's still the same.
And your book reflects that. Because in the long run, Greg does make a peace with some of the people who tormented him most, and they now have found a way to understand one another in ways they never had before.
When he went back to the reunion, I have no doubt that a few of his classmates weren't happy to see all of the to-do that was made over this reconciliation and over him, but they sure weren't saying anything to him directly about it. They sure would have 50 years ago.
If you'd like to learn more about Jim Auchmuty's book and about Koinonia, we've posted information on the Two Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS and on our Facebook page. By the way, our thanks to Atlanta actor Tom Key, who you heard reading the excerpt from David Morgan's letter of apology to Greg Whitcamper. When we return, we'll talk to another Atlanta author whose new book has been named one of the 10 books every Georgian should read, poet Kevin Young. Welcome back to Two Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. Today we're talking with authors whose books are on the just-released 2016 list of 10 books every Georgian should read. The books were selected by a panel of writers, librarians, educators, and others. Poet Kevin Young's Blue Laws, Selected and Uncollected Poems, is one of those featured books. Young's work has won him acclaim as one of the finest voices of his generation. His past books have been celebrated by organizations like The New Yorker magazine and National Public Radio. He's won countless literary awards and earlier this year was inducted into the prestigious American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Young teaches poetry and creative writing at Emory University. We talked to him in May, shortly after he was announced as a new member of the American Academy. You talk about Blue Laws as being both about blue laws, which are those Sunday prohibitions that good Christians put in place.
I love those. You know, like don't shoot across a river or on Sunday or something, or cut your hair this way.
No woman shall kiss her child on the Sabbath or fasting day.
Yeah.
Men stealers shall suffer death.
Which never happened, really.
Nobody was executed for stealing a man.
For slavery. I don't think, you know. So I was thinking about all the ironies of these, you know.
And, what does that mean to you?
You know, some of them are worried about the wrong thing.
The other thing that you say the title comes from is the blues. Music pervades almost everything you've done in your writing, doesn't it?
It does. You know, and it kind of starts with that fiddle on the cover. You know, and on the back cover is actually a guitar that I found under my grandmother's bed. It doesn't have any strings, but it's a beautiful object. And I really want to show these two objects, which are sort of totems for me. They're kind of poles of the named, known family member, a literal ancestor. And then this guitar, I don't know why she kept it. I found it after she died. But it still says something to me. It still sings to me, even though it's stringless. And it's that kind of namelessness and that known quality that I'm really interested in and that the blues really play with. You know, they talk about naming and the self. And they talk about irony and work and love and loss. And because they're the backbone, the architecture, the architect, I would even say, of American music, taking them on or talking about them is a real opportunity to talk about all the other music that they inspired. And, you know, the spirituals that they came from and some of the other music that predates them. But really their dominance, if you think about their descendants in country western or soul music or even reggae, hip-hop, those kinds of world musics that really dominate, I find I end up writing about most all of those.
Yeah, and I'm fascinated by the fact that your arc in terms of the music that you will put into, in some ways, your poems, you do go back to spirituals, slave songs, and you'll come all the way up to a Danger Mouse. I mean, you really are part of the sweep of American music and often African-American music.
Sure, yeah. I mean, and one of the points of, I wrote a book called The Gray Album, and a nonfiction book, and it was really trying to think about the ways African-American culture is American culture and defining it and redefining it. And I was really interested in those, again, transformations.
Let's talk about that. I'm glad you brought up The Gray Book, because one of the people who is prominent in The Gray Book is Phyllis Wheatley. Who is Phyllis Wheatley?
She's the first poet, African poet, published in America. You know, she was stolen when she was probably 9 or so. They don't know. And she was sold to a family in Boston and renamed after the slave ship that took her, which is just haunting to be named Phyllis because of that. And, you know, she wrote one book. She actually probably wrote another book. We know that this book existed. She advertised for it. There are poems from it, but people think that the manuscript was maybe taken from her, perhaps even by her sort of husband who wasn't so great, and it may be broken up in pieces. More importantly to me, she wrote her way sort of out of slavery. Certainly she wrote her way to travel to London to get to seek donors to get this book published. And I think getting that book published in 1773 is such a landmark. And, you know, at Emory, where I'm also a curator, we have a copy of it, and it's just amazing to see with this beautiful frontispiece. And then you turn the page, and it's signed. And you think,
wow.
She had a book tour. You know, I've seen other signed books. She signed her book. She was an author. You know, it wasn't simply she wrote some poems and someone else gathered them. She really thought about it. And those poems I tried to understand as a way of talking back to tradition and also talking about her plight. She writes a lot about female gods, about the deaths of other people's children, even though she lost herself to children or would go on to. So I think of them as very coded and full of meaning that, you know, people sometimes interpret, take either too literally or read in a way that doesn't really get at the nuance of what she's doing.
It's astonishing to think that a woman who was brought to this country as a slave ended up, as you say, buying her way out of slavery, was acknowledged as an artist in her time, published a book, and became a free woman because of it.
Well, and you know, I don't want to overstate, you know, her mistress, as it were, still kept her a slave, even though they went to, she went to Europe and then was called back because her mistress had taken sick. And we can only imagine the freedom she felt, though, crossing this Atlantic. And there's a poem in which I try to do that, recrossing it the other way to go to London. And, you know, she was literally free as soon as she stepped on that soil.
Yeah.
That said, she came back and still experienced slavery in the States, in Massachusetts, in Boston, in one of the seats of freedom. And she also experienced the American Revolution. It's right at her doorstep. And she, in fact, wrote about the affray, the Boston Massacre. And so I try to imagine, too, her thinking about Crispus Attucks, the famous black martyr in the Boston Massacre who sort of helped jumpstart the revolution. Long story short, I really tried to get inside both her imagination in some way, but also sort of the American imagination. And what an amazing thing that she was in, as you said, this person enslaved, but also writing and also free and also not, and really sort of negotiating, you know, British patrons, which were many of the supports of her book, and also this new republic being made around her.
Is there a little piece of that poem that you wrote about her feelings as she was coming back basically to slavery?
This is from a poem called A Farewell to America. Docked among the fog and slight sun of London, you know who you are not, but that is little new. Native of nowhere, you'll stay a spell, return, write, grow still. I wake with you in my mind, leaning, learning to write. Your slight profile, that long pull of lower lip, its pout, proving you rescued by some sadness too large to name. My most excellence, my quill and ink lady, you scrawl such script no translation it needs. Your need is what's missing, unwritten wish to cross back, but not back, into that land for you of the dead. You want to see from above deck the sea, to pluck from wind a sense no land can give.
That's Kevin Young reading from one of the poems that he wrote about the African-American poet who was a slave, Phyllis Wheatley. You know what occurred to me when I was reading your Phyllis Wheatley poems? Here's a woman literally enslaved, an artist trying to break free as an artist. And your poetry, I think, has themes that represent a very similar thing. Black artists trying to be free to have their own identity in the work that they create and a way in which they're received by the world around them. Is that a fair statement?
I mean, I think everyone's trying to write about freedom. For me, or some version of that, it's especially as an African-American writer, that's one of the huge themes. But also, I think you're right that there's a level of individuality, of seeking, of searching that I see in her work and in her struggle. I mean, I think struggle is a large part of the tradition.
When did you know poetry was going to be your medium?
I think it was the other way around. Poetry came for me. It felt like a vocation, like I didn't have a choice. Other people around me would say they knew before I knew. Sometime in college, I realized that the poems I was writing weren't as terrible as I felt they were. And I certainly didn't say, oh, I'm a poet, you know, but I certainly read poetry. I wrote it. I was writing most of the poems that became my first book, and sort of a fever it felt. But to me, it was as much testimony as poetry. It was as much telling this sort of ghost story of my family. And that's why, I almost say it was a ghost story. It was like you had to tell this tale or testimony.
What's an example of a ghost story about your family? Do you have one?
I mean, you know, there were always these stories about, like, we lost this land. This is what happened to this land. See all this? This used to be all ours. Some of that gets told in fragmented form in my first book. I definitely want to write about the art world in this book and think about him. And also sort of black genius. You know, it's a long poem. And the great thing about Scott is he painted about history. He painted about boxers. He painted about jazz musicians. So thinking about him gave me a chance to write about these other people.
Yeah, you really like to write about popular culture.
Sure.
Is there a little piece of Basquiat that you could
read for us?
Sure,
let's see what we got. This is a late poem in the book. It's called Shrine Outside Basquiat's Studio, September 1988. It talks about after he died and the shrine that popped up afterwards. Back on Great Jones, his face against the facade, fronting the carriage house rented from Warhol. Inside, his suits stiffen from starch, spilt paint. He's bought the farm whole, enchilada and all. August, and the heat covering everything, needle sharp, asleep. No more feeding his habit art. He's gone and done it this time, taken his last dive. Exit, stage right, a broken record. His black skin thick, needled into song. A swan's. Upon graffitied brick, insidious menace, landlord tenant. Folks pile candles, flowers, photos, notes to God and lace. Anything to repel ghosts, keep his going at bay before memory comes early, snarling, and sweeps him into the mouth of euphemism. Sanitation worker. Waste management engineer, garbage man, dumpster diver, trash heap, heaven.
Jean-Michel Basquiat died at, I think, age
27.
27.
You know, that sort of horrible age that a lot of our pop stars have died.
Right. You write about another figure in American 20th century history, but also certainly an icon of culture. You wrote an entire book of poems about Jack Johnson, is that right?
Well, there's a long poem for him. I mean, it's you know, 10 or 12 poems that's in the Basquiat book, actually.
I was just going to say, I was going to say, actually. Why Basquiat and Jack Johnson in the same book?
Well, he painted a portrait of Jack Johnson that's just sort of like a crown and a fist, you know, and I love that picture, as do others. And so for me, I was like, oh, Jack Johnson. And frankly, I don't think I knew who Jack Johnson was at that point. I was fairly young. To find out about the first black heavyweight champ and sort of the travails he had to go through and these sort of trumped up charges against him, he had to leave the country and because he couldn't be beaten in the ring, you know, and fascinating figure. And I just wanted to sort of capture his energy, which didn't seem dissimilar to Basquiat's. He had this great showman quality and love of life, you know, had these travails as well.
Some of them, not only did the white world around him, were they frustrated by the fact they could not find a white champion to beat him, but Jack Johnson also was out and about with white women quite.
And he was a flashy guy who, you know, he raced sports cars, you know, when cars weren't even really, most people didn't have a, you know, car, much less a horse. So here he is racing. And there's that great anecdote, which I include as a sort of epigraph about Jack Johnson racing, you know, driving, i.e. racing, getting stopped by a cop and said, you know, you're driving too fast, you're speeding, the fine is $50, and he gives him $100, and he says, why'd you give me $100? It's $50. He says, because I'm going to be coming back through here the same way.
That's a great story. So it would be great if you'd read one of the Jack Johnson poems. Which one would be a good one?
Let's try The Fix.
And what does that tell us about?
That's about, you know, Jack Johnson was exiled, and he always claimed that he threw this fight in Cuba, Jack Johnson claimed, in order to get let back into the States, and that there was a payoff. The Fix, 5 April, 1915. That fight with Willard was a fix, not a face-off. Out of the ring, 3 years, jonesing for the States, I struck a deal to beat the man act. One taste of Matt, and I'd get let back home. But I even told my mama, Tiny, bet on me. Once in the bout run out of Mexico by Pancho Villa himself, I fought that fix the way. Years back, Ketchell knocked me down even after we'd shook and agreed I'd take the fall if he carried me the rounds without trying to KO. Crossed, doubled over, I stood up and broke his teeth like a promise at the root. On the canvas, they shined white as a lie. But with Willard, that spring, each punch was a sucker, every round a gun, loaded. Still, I fixed him, strung him along the ropes for 25 rounds. At 26, the alphabet in my head gave way. Saw my wife take the take, count our 50 grand, and leave. Did the dive, shielding my eyes. Not so much from Havana heat, its reek, my favorite cigar, as from the ref's count. Down, I counted two blessings instead of bets. Stretched there on the canvas, a masterpiece, stripped of my title, primed to return to the States. Saved. Best believe I stood up smiling.
That's beautiful. Thank you for reading that, Kevin. You've written about a number of African Americans in American history who have been the victims of violence, prejudice. Emmett Till, in your newest collection of poems, you wrote a poem called Money Road, which is the New Yorker published.
Yeah,
first.
It's in no collection yet, but yeah. One day.
Yeah. You wrote the libretto to an Oratio about Booker Wright. I was really fascinated when I saw you'd written that. Booker Wright had a fascinating history. He found himself in an NBC documentary about Mississippi in the heat of the civil rights days. Tell us a little about him.
Yeah, I believe it was 1966, and NBC came down to do a documentary, especially in Greenwood, Mississippi. And Booker Wright owned a bar called Booker's Place, which made him sort of prominent. And then he also was a prominent waiter at this place called Lusco's in Greenwood, which is the fanciest restaurant and where all the power brokers dined, white power brokers. And, you know, there was all black wait staff, which was fairly typical And, you know, you could make good money as a waiter. And you know, people do now. They had him talk about and actually perform the menu, which was amazing, which is what he did.
He's looking right into the camera.
right.
Talking
and
to
reciting
us.
This menu, you know, like it's like a little poem. But then then he turns and says, you know, well, this is what my customers say. And he describes his customers and some of the racist things they say to him. I mean, they're horrible. And then he says, I want better for my kids. That's sort of all he says. I mean, he tells the truth. And for that, he was beaten by an off-duty cop and put in the hospital very severely. And, you know, he lost his job and, you know, faced real consequences for speaking out. And I think the community always revered him for doing that. I think the thing that attracted me to him was because he also was a kind of quiet rebel. I think sometimes we focus a lot on, you know, people who did these huge things, which I think is so important. You know, I don't want to minimize at all, except to say that there's also these everyday rebellions and resistances by waiters and porters and, you know, maids. People all across the South made the civil rights movement. And that was important, I think, to remember with Booker.
So we're going to listen first to just a little bit of Mr. Wright talking to the NBC camera, and then go directly into a little piece of the oratorio for which you wrote the libretto.
Now, that's what my customers, I say my customers, be expecting of me. When I come in, this way won't be dressed. Booker, tell my people what you got. Some people are nice, some are not. Some call me Booker, some call me John, some call me Jim, some call me nigger. All of that hurts, but you have to smile. If you don't, what's wrong with you? Why are you not smiling? Get over there and get me so-and-so.
When do you talk about it? The men never won. Who come for you, burning and cutting and crossing, even a pig. Pistol can be made a whip just for you saying what's true, not what you're taught. That's a good nigger. That's my nigger. Brush your taut.
So that was the oratorio that our guest Kevin Young wrote using the words of Mississippi waiter Booker Wright. The poem that you wrote about your father's death, how long ago did he pass away?
He died 11 years ago.
Okay.
No, sorry, 12.
So this is bereavement.
Yeah. Bereavement. Behind his house, my father's dogs sleep in kennels. Beautiful. He built just for them. They do not bark. Do they know he is dead? They wag their tails and head. They beg and are fed. Their grief is colossal and forgetful. Each day they wake, seeking his voice, their names. By dusk, they seem to unremember everything. To them, even hunger is a game. For that I envy. For that I cannot bear to watch them pacing their cage. I try to remember they love best confined space to feel safe. Each day a saint comes by to feed the pair, and I draw closer the shades. I've begun to think of them as my father's other sons, as kin, brothers in paw. My eyes each day thaw. One day the water cuts off, then back on. They are outside dogs, which is to say healthy and victorious, purposeful, and one giant muscle, like the heart. Dad taught them not to bark, to point out their prey, to stay. Were they there that day? They call me like witnesses and will not say. I ask for their care, and their carelessness. Wish of them forgiveness. I must give them away. I must find for them homes, sleep restless in his. All night I expect they pace as I do, each dog like an eye, roaming with the dead beneath an unlocked lid.
That's Kevin Young reading his poem Bereavement, which is about the death of his father. Kevin Young, I am really grateful that you would spend some time with us and share your poetry. It's so beautiful to hear you read it yourself.
Oh, thank you.
Congratulations on the publication of Blue Laws and your election to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Thanks so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Kevin Young's book, Blue Laws, has been selected as one of the 10 books every Georgian should read. That's a list compiled by the Georgia Center for the Book. You can see the complete list on the Two-Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS and on our Facebook page. That's our show for this week. Don't forget, if you can't be near a radio when we're on the air, you can listen by subscribing to the Two-Way Street podcast on iTunes. And you can always catch up with past shows on our website. Our senior producer is the remarkable Jenny Amond. Our producer is Trevor Young. And our wonderful interns are Hannah Rose Adams and Caroline Hayes. Caroline's leaving us this week, headed back to the University of Georgia. She's been a great addition to our team, and we wish her well. We'll miss you, Caroline. I hope you think about us every now and then. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for listening. Hope to see you again next week for another Two-Way Street.